This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome to 2021. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. This is episode 285 with Matthew Burrows. He is an English painter and the founder of Artist Support Pledge, which is a crowdsourcing, Instagram-based way for people to sell their work, get it out there, make a living even. Much more on that in a bit. Happy 2021, everybody. We're off to a wild and crazy start. And, I mean, where to start, right? It's really intense COVID-wise here in Los Angeles. I mentioned that in my e-blast recently. And before when you were aware of sort of the quiet and whatnot, it was just kind of chill, and relaxed in a way. But now there is that, but with an edge of, oh, I got to be really careful, you know, when I start going to the store, mixing it up otherwise, because, yeah, you know the deal. There's a new strain that apparently is that much more contagious. So be careful, everybody. Stay safe. Wear your mask, blah, blah, blah. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Matthew's paintings, him running an ultra marathon, which he is a doer of. We talk about that towards the beginning of the episode. And a desk in his studio in East Sussex, which frames the rolling hills outside. And as he says in our conversation, he is in a location only an hour from London, and yet he can see no other structures from his property. So that's pretty sweet. Yeah, before we get more to the episode, I have a few things I wanted to address. One of them is, speaking of the craziness that is going on right now, particularly here in the States, I thought we had a pretty fucking hilarious meme to address that on Instagram the other day, and it frankly bombed, especially when you compare it to the prior meme that just hit a record for us in terms of popularity. And I don't know, can you guys give me some feedback on it? Or if you haven't seen it, go check it out and like it. I thought it was hilarious, and I haven't told you what it is, so I'm not completely biasing you, but I know I'm giving you pretty high expectations. But I chuckled at it a number of times, for what it's worth. So go check it out at Artist Podcast on Instagram, and at least let me know what you think if you haven't liked it. I want to give you a recommendation for a band that is actually not a current band, but I have discovered, or I should say, I have personally discovered that I want to share with you, you know, because we are in the habit of doing recommendations from time to time, especially on the cafe. And speaking of the cafe, the virtual cafe, which is a gathering of listeners sometimes to talk art-related things via prompts and sometimes with a special guest presenter. I just spoke with a new special presenter who we're going to set up as soon as next Saturday, the 16th of January. So wanted to give you a heads up on that. His name is Robin Kaiser Schatzlein, and he wrote a piece in the New Republic reviewing a book about the survival and history of the creative class, which is bookended by his own experience working in the art world and in unionizing, so as a preparator. So we are going to talk about that, all the things related to that, some of his experiences, and I think it should be really interesting, and I want you guys to come with questions. And if you haven't read that article, go read it. I'm sorry I don't have the name in front of me, but just look up Robin Kaiser Schatzlein, The New Republic Creative Class, and you will find it. And so that's going to come up soon, and I would love to see more of you there on short notice. I think it's going to be Saturday morning noon/noon Pacific time, so 3 p.m. East Coast time, 9 p.m. Germany, etc., 8 p.m. UK, Australia. I guess you are screwed again, Van, but you know, you'll be there on January 16th. So, yeah, hope to see you guys at that. I will send out an email about it. But if you're not already on the email list, email me, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, and I will add you to that list. Big thank you to all the supporters on Patreon who continue to support this podcast and the recent donors on PayPal. And if you guys listen and like this show, hey, New Year is a great time to start supporting a entity like this, right? It's really just a great way to show your support. Very much appreciated. And I can get you some bonus episodes. There are many, including one that I can make from this particular upcoming episode, because I cut out a whole section where Matthew talks about his painting and the perspective that he has about it in the context of the greater world. So that, and among other numerous bonus episodes from the past, would love to share those with you by your becoming a supporter of the show. I want to thank Van Cacinero, Adam Vale, and Lydia Kegler for all of their help making this show possible. And by the way, Adam Vale is going to have to, for the time being, step down because he's too busy to contribute to the show. So we could use an extra pair of hands on deck. If you're interested, reach out, please. Also wanted to thank former guest Lee Wagstaff for recommending Matthew Burroughs to me. He is a very ardent user of the Artist Support Pledge. And so hopefully he will take part in a virtual cafe in the future where we can talk about that. So Matthew is an English artist, a painter. He is the founder of Artist Support Pledge, which, as I said, operates on Instagram. It's not something that I had been familiar with other than through Lee Wagstaff, who's based in Berlin. I haven't seen any artists that I follow in the U.S. using it. Apparently, it's big in the U.K. and elsewhere in Europe. Yeah, so we talk about all those things, among others. And as part of his creating Artist Support Pledge and the success that it has had, he rocketed to number 37 in Art Review's Power 100 list for 2020. By the way, I have been a perpetual candidate for Hyperallergic's Least Powerful People in the Art World. So apparently I didn't make that list again. And Matthew was also recently awarded Members of the Order of the British Empire for 2020. That is MBE is the abbreviation for that title. So I guess it's sort of like a more community oriented version of a knighthood, or maybe, you know, something like that. So congrats to him, and great that we got him on the show. And yet apparently it's not that much of a stretch, because he is doing 2 to 3 recordings or interviews a day. So yeah, well, we got him too. All right. So my final thing before we finally jump into this episode is clunkily lovely segue from talking about the fact that because of the chaos on the Capitol, that happened earlier in the week, the news of the wins in the runoff in Georgia for the Senate seats, the two Senate seats that were in runoff, got completely buried. And that was a great thing that happened. And my segue is that, speaking of Georgia, I have come to fall in love with a band called Pylon, P-Y-L-O-N, in case you haven't heard of them, from Athens, Georgia, who formed in 1978 and put out their first album, Gyrate, in 1980. That is the album, the CD, that I have been listening to as of the last couple of weeks. And it is awesome, to the point that I am saying I will put this up against any rock CD. That's how much I'm impressed and enamored of this piece of art and work. Now, let's be fair, or let's be honest, that I am clearly still very within the realm or reach of the honeymoon phase. But I have never said, when I've been in prior honeymoon phases with albums that I've fallen in love with, said I will put this up against any rock album. So that is a new twist. I just want to finish this spiel with the question, for any of you who are familiar with them, and ideally even got to see them, they had three different eras. The original era in the early 80s, I think another one in the mid 90s, and then another one in the early 2000s, something like that, because of various circumstances. So that's to say that any number of you who are big music buffs could have seen them in the early 2000s. And if you did, or if you know somebody who think might have, please let me know how bad they are so I can destroy my, this buildup that I have created. No, but I would really love to hear what they must have been absolutely amazing live. So let me know. Thank you guys so much for being here and for listening. One other thing I should add, we do talk quite a bit about Artist Support Pledge and actually starting your own towards the end of the conversation. And I talk about, being on the verge of doing it myself. I did not do it. I have not done it. It's not the right time. It hasn't been the right time with my work and with, with starting an endeavor like that. So, but if you have, and, or if you're about to, maybe inspired by this conversation, do let us know. All right. Enjoy. Happy New Year. Stay safe. And talk to you guys in a couple weeks. Until then, be well. So where are you, Matthew?
Yeah, so my studio where I am now is in East Sussex, which is about an hour outside of London, sort of south of London, just off the coast. So I'm literally in the countryside, about sort of 50 miles or so outside of London.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been there?
I've been here now for 8 years. I moved here to build a studio 8 years ago, and then spent a kind of year building the studio, and I've been living and working here since.
Mm-hmm. What was going on with your living situation while you were building the studio?
Oh, that was complicated. I had another studio that I was renting, so I was commuting for about an hour each way every day to my old studio whilst this studio was being built.
Mm-hmm.
For the last, probably the last 2 or 3 months of the build, I actually had to stop doing that because I was over managing the build itself, and that sort of took over my life. So I just had to stop making work for a few months whilst the building has been completed. It was all worth it.
So you have a property on which you built the studio that you're in, and was there already a home there that you were going to live in or were living in?
Yeah, we bought a very old sort of mill house here, and it's actually the site of an old windmill.
Huh.
So the windmill had been taken down about 100 years ago, but it had a large plot that I could build the studio on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very convenient, but I didn't have to build the house, just the studio.
Right, got it. And so is the house then as unusual as it sounds?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very old house. I mean, parts of it go back to 1600s. So,
wow.
And it's been sort of, like a lot of houses in this part of England, they've sort of been added to over the centuries. So it's a hodgepodge of different periods. But it's quite quirky, and we love it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different from my studio, which is very contemporary and very open.
Right. So is this kind of a sort of somewhat classical example of an artist who's done or doing well, who sort of moves out into the, out of the city, to kind of escape the grind or have some peace or what have you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think of it really, I mean, that's what I did in real terms. But I think over sort of maybe a 20-year period of living in London and making work there, I started to realize that actually it actually wasn't very good for me.
Right.
And I sort of convinced myself for years that it was.
Mm.
And then I realized that I actually prospered most as an artist and creatively when I had a certain level of connection to sort of nature and a certain sort of solitude. So I sort of thought I really had to take the plunge and just actually make that life. make the life that best suited the work that I wanted to make. And it was sort of felt like a risk at the time, but it paid off.
Mm. To what extent, though, was the connections and connectivity of being in the city related to your being able to sort of facilitate this move in the first place, though, right? Is there kind of a little bit of an inner conflict there to some extent?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose maybe like a lot of artists, I sort of felt like I had to be in the focus and the hub of cultural life in, you know, in London.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that's potentially changed a lot, I suppose, in the last 20 years with the way we can connect through the internet and social media now. It's made keeping in touch and staying connected, even with my gallery, so much easier. So in a way, you know, I didn't face those sorts of challenges that maybe I would have done if it had been 30 or 40 years ago.
Mm.
And in many ways, actually, it forced me to be a bit more connected with people, because I think I took a lot of that for granted when I lived in London.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I moved out, I really had to sort of, you know, try a little harder to keep connected to people and stay in touch.
Where is your gallery?
It's a gallery called Vigo Gallery, and it's in, well, it's actually between spaces because it just moved out of a space before lockdown.
Mm.
So it was in Mayfair. So it's right in central London.
Okay. So that relationship, do you think that relationship would have begun had you been living where you are now?
Well, I'd already moved out of London when I started being represented by Vigo Gallery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and they actually came out of London to see me. So it's, you know, in that respect, no, it didn't make any difference. I mean, I'm sure, I think at the beginning of my career, I don't think I could have done this.
Right.
I was well established enough and had enough connections to take that risk at that point. I'd been working in London for 20 years.
Right.
So I was, you know, well connected enough to be able to sort of make that move out. And a lot of artists do it. I don't think it's actually that unusual, but I think a lot of it really is about what best suits you. You know, for some it is being in the center of London. For me, I really felt like I needed that, you know, I needed to manifest in my life, my work, the kind of context that was best suited to my creative personality, really.
Mm, mm-hmm. How much do you think there's an analog in London with New York, you know, New York City area, and then people having sort of country or Hamptons, you know, or what have you, homes that they go to? So is that maybe only for a certain level of artist in London?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the South, I mean, like New York, actually, but the South, the Southeast of UK is very expensive for real estate.
Mm.
So it's quite unusual for people to have both, but there's certainly, you know, there certainly is that situation where there's an awful lot of artists who've made that move outside of London. I mean, I have a lot of friends around here who've done exactly the same thing, who have, you know, taken the plunge and moved out of London. Some still have properties in London, but they spend a lot of their time out here, living and working out here.
Well, that sounds to me, though, like, you know, if they still have property in the city, that sounds like an iteration of the, you know, artist who's successful enough to be able to live and have spaces in both places. Yeah,
certainly for people like that. Yes. I mean, I'm not in that position.
Right.
So I don't have one in each.
Right. Right.
But I don't think I would need it either. I mean, I'm in London fairly frequently. So I'm in London probably, well, I'm not at the moment because of COVID-19, but pre-COVID-19, I'd have been in London, you know, maybe once a week or every other week. Even if it's just going to see exhibitions or meeting with my gallery, or, you know, sometimes going in to do, you know, to lecture at a university or something.
Right.
So, you know, I don't feel disconnected from London, and it's only, you know, literally from my studio door into the center of London, it's just over an hour.
Mm. Yeah, that's close.
Yeah, quite quick.
Yeah, and the sort of the country as it is often called outside of London is actually often more dense and not urban, but, you know, but just sort of very, you know, not at all sort of quiet and you know, sleepy and pastoral the way it tends to be in the States. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate for a lot of the countryside outside of London, but where I am is probably the most remote bit. If you're looking out of my studio window, you can't see any buildings for as far as the eye can see.
Wow.
And it just so happens, I mean, I guess it's probably one of the reasons why I wanted to be here, but I happen to have, found a spot within East Sussex that is fairly quiet.
Yeah.
There's enough around here for it not to be cut off. And Hastings, which is a town which is about 10 miles from here, that has a really thriving art scene and contemporary art gallery. So, I'm not completely out in the sticks.
Yeah, that's kind of my impression. When you're in that part of the country, you're never that far. It might be different if you're in the north, I suppose, but
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
yeah.
I actually used to live in America, just outside of New York State for a year. I had a studio there, and so in many ways, it's not. I mean, America, the landscape of America is much more dramatic and much kind of wilder in its drama. This part of the UK is very, it's quite tame. It's very rolling. It's very beautiful, but it's not that. It's not got the sort of wild nature that I think, a lot of the American landscape has.
Which wild nature are you referring to that you got to experience for a year?
Well, I was, well, I mean, I used to regularly, as you probably, I don't know whether you know this, but I'm very much into kind of endurance sports as well.
Right, we can talk
I used
about
to kind
that.
of regularly kind of find myself on the Appalachian Trail through Connecticut and Vermont when I was in that part of the world. So, that's, you go up into the mountains there and you can very quickly get lost. It's quite hard to get lost around here.
I see. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of what I was partially getting at when I was saying how, even though you're in the country, it's like you're never ultimately that far from people or places.
No,
Yeah.
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that actually, because that was one of the sort of things we exchanged emails about. And I'd be curious to hear more about. Can you talk about this one particular, endurance event that you were involved with that was, pretty substantial for you?
I think the one you're referring to was a race which is the length of the Lake District in the UK. So it goes from the northern tip all the way down to the southern base across the mountains. So it's 50 miles. So in ultra running, which is what I do, it's not the longest, but it's quite a tough race because you literally go over the worst mountains to get from the start to the finish. And this was 2 or 3 years ago. The first time I did it, I think, and the weather was appalling. I mean, the worst weather I've ever experienced in my life. And I ended up having to pull out, I think, at about 30 miles because of hypothermia. And it was pretty, it wasn't a nice thing to experience because it was the first time I've ever been in that situation where I really felt like I was in danger. And when it set in, I was on a mountain in thick fog. I couldn't see anybody. When you get hypothermia, you lose control, so you can't function in the way that you'd normally function. You can't, even if you could meet somebody, you wouldn't be able to explain what was going on. And you can't. Your hands don't function. Your brain's not functioning properly. But I had enough, wits about myself, and I, you know. I've been up in the mountains all my life. I sort of knew what to do and I knew how to get out of it. But it was pretty scary. And I remember afterwards, sort of feeling a bit frustrated that I'd pulled out, but I had to. I mean, I was in no fit state to carry on at that point. But I was frustrated myself for getting to that into that situation. I'd made mistakes. I'd made mistakes and put myself in danger. And so that was frustrating. But really, the big thing that I took away from it was this sense that I faced fear in a way that I'd never faced it. And I think that as an artist is a very, it's a very profound experience because fear has got so much to do with your creativity. The fact that you can keep being pushing forward with what you do, even though you never know really where you're going. There's always this kind of backdrop of sense of fear in making art. And I think facing that fear on that day, when I really did feel fear in such a big way, was actually tremendously empowering. Mm. And I realized, you know, for the year after that, it really had an impact on how I thought about being an artist and, you know, how I took the next steps into being an artist. And then, you know, I think I'd be just briefly discussed this in our email correspondence that about 8 months later, it was in another race again in the Lake District, not so severe. The weather was kind, but I think I was probably about 30 miles into the race and I was feeling extremely tired. It was been a really tough race. And I'd come down from one of the mountains and I was just passing someone at the side of a footpath. And they said to me, they smiled and said, "Do you ever stop to look at the view?" And I remember it like it was a sort of vision. It was very weird. Mm. Because I remember thinking at the time, it's a very good question. But actually, for me, it feels as if it's irrelevant because I have been that view for the last 6 or 7 hours or something, however long it had been. That view had been part of my body. And my experience of that view wasn't distant. It was absolutely intrinsically and intimately linked with my very being. And that completely threw my sense of what it was to be a painter, an artist in relationship to nature. Because so much of what I think I thought of as making art about nature was through this idea of the view. You look at something. When you look at something, you frame it. You kind of picture it, if you like. You put a frame around it and create a picture of it. And by doing that, in effect, what you're doing is controlling it. You're actually saying, "I own that view. I own that thing. I possess it. It's mine." So it becomes a kind of resource and it becomes something you control. But that wasn't my experience of the natural environment. And certainly endurance running, it wasn't what I found. You know, if you feel like you're in control of nature, you're in a very dangerous situation. And you've got to really respect that it will do what it wants. And you have to kind of go along with that, but use all your skills and your ability to navigate, your ability to make good decisions in difficult situations, to make sure you survive it. So that sort of analogy between surviving a severe storm in, you know, extreme conditions and understanding how you might navigate your relationship to nature as an artist sort of took on a whole new meaning to me. And then that opened up into a whole other set of issues to do with, you know, the environment and sort of pre-industrial societies, which is, you know, a lot of what I've been thinking of for the last year.
Can we go back to that first race for a second? So what did you do if you had hypothermia? You know, you said on one hand you lose control, but you also said you had sort of had enough, you know, experience or, you know, wherewithal based on that experience to get out of it. But what did you need to do? I mean, did you have to find somebody, I presume?
Yeah, initially I did find someone and, what I eventually, and that didn't work. We tried to talk to one another and we were both confused. I eventually found out later that he also had hypothermia. It was a particularly bad race and I can't remember the odds now, but I think only 40% of the people got through it, which actually is quite high given how bad it was.
Yeah.
And obviously that didn't work. So where I was within the race, when it started to go bad, I knew that I still had at least another 2 hours of running to do, probably 3 hours, I think, now thinking back, that before I could get to safety. And I do this all the time, so I know that might sound a bit severe to a lot of people, but I knew that even, you know, I could probably do that. I could muster it. All I had to do was make sure that I was going in the right direction. And I knew that although I couldn't see more than 5 meters and the weather was so appalling that you could barely stand up, I knew that as long as I went in the right direction, I would eventually end up at safety. And the right direction was fairly straightforward because it was straight ahead. So right. You were either going down a mountain or you were going straight ahead because we were following a ridge. So it was just about following the ridge. And, you know, it was a good few hours of feeling extraordinarily uncomfortable. Mm. It was more than 3 hours, actually, thinking back, I'm trying to remember it all now. But it was a very, very weird experience. And you know, one of those experiences you have in your life, which I think you learn. I learned so much on that day. I've since been back and done the race again. The weather wasn't so bad. So I didn't have to suffer the same kind of consequences, but I was certainly nervous on that day.
It sounds like if the only solution to dying from hypothermia was to keep going and to get to wherever the rescue crews were.
Yeah, well, you do. I mean, without making it sound too dramatic, you do have an SOS button which is attached to your bag. Mm. So you know, I could have put my hand on that, and the mountain rescue team would have come and got me. But with something like that, it almost the worst thing you can do is stop, because if you stop, my body temperature is already really too low. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really low, and the only way of keeping it slightly elevated was to keep moving.
Right.
So, although it was extremely uncomfortable and it wasn't pleasant to keep moving, it was actually what would keep me alive. So it was just keep moving, you know. So it was a simple decision, really. Don't stop. And you don't, you know, to get into these sorts of races, you can't just turn up and do one. You know, you have to qualify to do them. It, you know, if you're not prepared for it, you don't do them. You know, these sorts of things you've got to be well prepared for. And you've got to prove that you can do them before you even let you in the race. Mm, mm-hmm. So it's not as if, you know, I wasn't really in kind of real danger, in the sense that I had enough experience and fitness and knowledge and, you know, support that I could have got out of it. But that doesn't change the way you feel about the situation you're in. I felt fear like I'd never felt fear before. Hmm. And that was really, and I felt it in a way that was very extremely raw, because it was in nature. It wasn't the sort of fear you feel potentially, say, if you're being burgled or you're,
right,
you know, in a situation where you think you're going to be mugged or something like that, yeah, you know, where, you know, that's real fear too.
Yeah.
But this was a fear that felt completely unlike anything else I'd felt. It felt so kind of natural in a way, because it was part of being in the elements and being part of, you know, I remember sort of at one point seeing this mountain briefly looming out of the mist as the mist cleared, and I could just see the top sort of, I guess, 100 meters of a peak that was just in front of me that I had to go over. So it was this sort of almost very classic looking black triangle of a mountain peak staring at me in this mist. And I, you know, to this day, I remember that for me was that kind of moment where I knew the mountain was saying, I don't give a damn. You know, I'm just sitting here, getting minding my own business. Your fear's all yours. And it felt like that was the sort of the situation I was in. And it was really, you know, a kind of profound situation to be in, really.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, I mean, to go back to your, you know, analogy about nature and, you know, the way that you see nature as an artist, and this terrifying, you know, this profoundly fearful episode, you know, in this race. I don't mean to be too dismissive, but couldn't you take that experience and whatever you do, that would be, you know, sort of a profound paradigm shift, you know, in the way that you view life, whatever it is that you do, whether you're an artist or, you know, you work an office job or you're an activist, whatever.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think the reason why, in a way, it profoundly shifted the way I thought as a painter was not because, you know, a painter or an artist has to have that experience. I think it's a lot to do with the fact that I think that in our sort of developed modern world, things like fear and discomfort are sort of, we're protected from them so often. Mm-hmm. By, you know, so many kind of mechanisms that sort of, that in a way, tell us that they're not good for us, that it's not good to feel fear, it's not good to be uncomfortable, that the, you know, that security and comfort are our highest values. Mm. And I'm just not convinced by that argument. I actually think we are more alive when we fear things, and we are more alive when we acclimatize to discomfort. I don't think to an artist that's kind of news in a way, because I think most artists know that they're most creative when they face fear, and they are, you know, that making art largely puts you in an uncomfortable position for very long periods of time. So I don't think it's news to any artist, really. I think it's just that I realized that by really going deep into that and actually really examining what it really means to feel uncomfortable and what it really means to fear something.
Right.
And to face that in a way, maybe in a way that I realized that I didn't know what my fear was. And I think in that context, perhaps my fear was failure. That actually not completing the race, it was the only race I've ever done that I've not completed. And which sounds minor, like, what big deal, who cares? And I would agree with that statement, really. But I think what I realized, because I didn't finish it, and because I didn't finish it because of an error and because it was so dramatic, I realized actually really my biggest fear was not the weather, was not the, you know, the hypothermia. It was actually the fear of not completing it.
Hmm.
And actually not completing it, even though, you know, I was frustrated by not completing it, actually really, it kind of, in a way, opened up a sense, a kind of vein of creativity in me that sort of said, it's okay, it's all right. It doesn't matter that you didn't finish it. And, I think maybe I knew that before, but I think it was because it was so dramatic that it really forced me to face it.
As far as an artist being uncomfortable, I would have to say that I'm in the camp that believes that it's more of the long haul, you know, or the long game as far as discomfort in terms of security and stability. Mm. You know, I mean, I'm certainly your description is more of kind of the process, I think. But I would put myself more in that other camp, and maybe you're in both, but certainly one of the ways that I am familiar with and look at people choosing to be artists, you know, no matter how that, whatever happens with their career, that seems like a, you know, the logistics of the lack of security and stability, which is definitely in great contrast to what you experience in that race, because it's such a slow burn, you know, whereas with what you were in, it's at the extreme of the moment, right? It's like you're fearing your mortality, whereas when you're concerned about your stability and security, that's like little ticks sort of over days, months, years.
Yeah, I think in a way, perhaps that sort of idea, I mean, and what I wouldn't want to suggest is that an artist shouldn't have, you know, a certain level of stability and security in their life. I think they, like anybody else, should have the right to a certain level of security. I think the issue really is that I think in a sort of society where we value that at its absolute peak, it almost creates an unbalance, because I think that actually it's about, you know, maybe this is the thing with artists who become successful. One of the greatest challenges for them then is managing that balance between their success and the need to feel on the edge,
mm-hmm.
and the need to feel that kind of edginess of creativity again. And I think, you know, a lot of artists I know who've had, you know, extreme success have had to sort of battle those demons and find their way through. And the good ones do. But, you know, there's an awful lot lying by the wayside who don't make it, who get, you know, who fail to kind of find a happy balance between the need for a certain level of uncertainty and fear in the act of creativity and the need to actually have a livelihood, mm-hmm. and be able to respond to that livelihood when it presents itself.
Mm. Let's talk about Artist Support Pledge, which is how I came to find you initially.
Yeah.
Could you first really concisely describe what it is and what sort of led you to initiate it?
Yeah, well, Artist Support Pledge really is a culture to support an economy to support artists and makers. So it's an idea that works on Instagram, where artists can post images of their work for sale on their account for no more than $200, with the pledge that when they reach $1,000 worth of sales, they will buy another artist's work for $200. And all they've got to do is use the hashtag Artist Support Pledge. Very simple. So it's just a very simple kind of concept, which I based on actually kind of pre-industrial society ideas, and attached this kind of notion of kind of generous culture attached to it, because for it to work, everyone had to act generously. And as it, you know, maybe some of your listeners know, it's now global, and it's certainly in the UK, it's completely everywhere. And it's, you know, it's fairly big in the US as well now.
Well, let me talk to you about that in a second. But first, I want to read at least one of these comments that you got. So one person says, "Hi, Matthew, I'm sure you're getting so many messages, but I wanted to contact you to say thank you. I reached my first £1,000 of sales yesterday, bought my first artwork, and paid my rent this morning with some sum towards my bills. I was in dire straits because of the lockdown, living on a shoestring at the best of times, but now I'm okay for the next month, and I've made my next sale this morning, so I might be okay the next month too. Just as important, though, is the community and culture of generosity you have been the catalyst for. I feel hopeful and purposeful, and that is an unexpected thing in these dark times." Mm. And somebody else used the expression dark times as well. Thank you so much for another one. Thank you so much for creating the pledge. I have struggled with art as a career for a decade now, in parentheses, single mom. This is the kind of support I have never come across. I wish it wasn't because of a pandemic, but I'm so thankful you thought of it. My resolve to keep pursuing my art and what I put out to the universe has surprisingly been stronger than ever over the last few weeks. I seriously felt like coming across your initiative just now is the universe smiling back at me. So I first found out about it from Lee Wagstaff. He is in Berlin, so in Europe, with roots in, he is English though. I have not seen any U.S. Artist Support Pledge drives, so maybe I'm just not following the right people, but talk about what you know about what's going on in the U.S. so far.
Yeah, it started happening in the U.S. fairly early on. You know, this would be late March. I mean, I don't completely understand how it's working there, but it's New York's the most going on in New York and also in California. But it's still, you know, it's still small compared to what it is in the UK, uh-huh. and given the scale of America. So, you know, really trying to sort of get more people involved. We've had, actually, there was an article in the New York Times last week. So that's made a big difference. So we've had a lot more coverage and a lot more participants in the US over the last sort of 5 or 6 days, actually.
Mm.
So I'm not sure why it's not grown as quickly in America as it has here. Mm-hmm. Or in Europe, mm-hmm. but it's, I mean, actually America still has, I think it's 18% of the usage of our support pledge, but given the size of America and the amount of people living there, that's, you know, a smaller percentage than what it should be. So and also what's interesting in the UK, a third of the buyers are from the US.
Hmm.
So that there's a lot of buyers in the US using it, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's caught on quite so readily with artists there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised that there's that much activity based on, you know, the none that I've seen essentially. But it's a great idea and a great platform. And I hope we can somehow get it going here. What do you recommend, having, you know, being the creator of it, what would you recommend for someone starting up, presuming that their followers don't know anything about it? You know, like, is it important to sort of do a post where you educate them about how it works before you start posting your actual works, you know, or what? What do you think?
Can do, but you don't really need to. If anyone who wants to use it goes to www.artistsupportpledge.com, there's a how-to page there which will tell you what to do. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. There's all the information you need is there. The text that you need to use is there, and the post titles are there. Once you've used the hashtag, so the great thing about it is, because the hashtag is universal,
right?
Everyone in the world who's using it goes to the same place. Mm. So they all get seen in the same place. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons it's so successful, because, and one of the reasons we have this idea of a generous culture, mm-hmm. because if I go to it and I put my work on it and use the hashtag, my followers and my collectors will see your work that's on it too. Mm. And vice versa. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing in effect is pooling all of our resources globally to support one another. So, you know, in many ways, it's been hard to sort of get people to understand that, because too often I think we tend to think through boundaries. You know, it's either American or it's German or it's Australian or it's English, whatever. But actually, the thing that's really interesting about a hashtag is it doesn't know those boundaries. It doesn't right. care for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was one of the reasons I used it, was I realized actually we could straight away get rid of all those boundaries, and everyone has that equal access. Mm. You know, there's no, I don't decide who goes on it and who doesn't go on it. Mm-hmm. Anyone can use it. So it's, you know, it's completely open culture. And that can be a bit disconcerting at first. You know, when you first, if you look at the hashtag, it can look a bit wild. You know, it's there's all sorts of stuff on there. But that's the nature of it, you know, and it's one of the things I often talk about is it's based on sort of hunter-gatherer societies. And I like this idea that when you're going on it, it's you're hunting and gathering. So you've got to know a few skills to navigate it and to actually learn and slowly get used to it. It's not like going to the supermarket and buying your food, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's not like going to a gallery where everything's already been selected and edited and curated for you.
Right.
There's no curatorial control on it. It's just artists and makers from all over the world, of all levels, of all abilities. But if you scroll through very quickly, you start coming across stuff, you think, oh, that's quite interesting. And then over the time that, you know, certainly I've been running it and managing it and using it, the amount of artists that I've come across that I'd never met before, never heard of before, who are really good, just through recommendations of other artists. So we have a number of sort of ideas attached to it. One of them is an InView, called an InView, mm-hmm. where what you can do is you can post an InView tile, and along with that InView tile, you post seven artists who you've discovered on Art Support Pledge, who you're following and you like. Mm. So that means that if someone goes onto your account and they click on your on view post, straight away they get to see the artist you're looking at. So they don't have to go through all your followers to find them. They can just click on that one post. So it allows you to share your community and your influencers and the people you admire. So it's very simple. I mean, in a way, you know, the whole thing is based on this premise that light touch and effective. Whatever it is, it's got to be very easy to do. Anyone should be able to access it and use it. And it's got to work. So it's actually got to make people a living. And it, I mean, it's been more successful than, to be honest, I ever would have dreamt of. Mm. You know, it's now, it's across the world now. It's still predominantly in English-speaking countries, but certainly, mm-hmm. You know, it's in you know, in every continent other than Antarctica.
Wow. Well done.
Yeah.
And you said you had used it yourself. Have you put your works up at some point?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I started it. I mean, when I... you know, when I came up with the idea for it, it was really, you know, a sort of sense that there was this global wave of desperation across the art world.
Right.
Where, you know, I knew so many artists who were losing their incomes overnight. Mm-hmm. Or exhibitions closing, etc. Mm-hmm. And this was potentially going to go on for not only 3 months, but much longer, as it has actually turned out. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I was fearful. I thought, how on earth is anyone going to survive this in the arts? Because I didn't see there was going to be any mechanism from within the industry or from government, whatever else, to support artists through that period. So I literally just came up with this idea. And the very first post in Art Support Pledge was me putting one of my etchings on, saying, I'll sell this for £200. Once I reach £1,000 worth of sales, I will buy another artist's work if they use the hashtag. And that was it. And within 2 or 3 days, it had gone viral and it was across the globe.
Wow.
And I've been using it since, partly because, A, I'm making a living off doing it as well, but also I've got to lead by example. So,
yeah,
you know, if I'm asking other people to do it, I should do it too.
Yeah, right. So you mentioned you're making a living off it without, you know, it's always a little sensitive, eggshelly when it comes to that and being an artist. But I don't know, are there any, without being too invasive, are there any stats that you would feel comfortable sharing around that?
Yeah, I mean, estimates at the moment, it's over 70 million globally that's generated. And that certainly if you're an artist, you know, who's successful on it, and a lot of artists are being, it's pretty easy to sell, you know, two or three a day on it.
Every day of the week?
Yeah.
So some people are making bank, in other words, is what you're saying. What about you, though? That was my initial question.
Yeah, I mean, well, I sell about 10 a week on it.
That's fantastic.
And I could sell a lot more, but I don't have the time to make them. I kind of figure that I don't always do 10 a week. I do between 10 and 6, actually, because that's what I kind of figure I can pay the bills. Keeps our support pledge going because I'm having to run it all and pay for things.
Yeah. Is it all your back catalog or is any of it new work?
Initially it was back catalog because I was just putting stuff on.
Right.
And then I ran out. And now I'm making work specifically for it. So,
okay.
I it's part of my working day is I spend, you know, part of each day just making, I mean, it's all part of my process of making work. So I was doing it previous to our support pledge. And that was one of the things that made me realize it would work is that most artists in their studio have works that never make it to the mainstream market because they're too small or they're not high enough in value for a gallery to make a profit. So they never make it into galleries.
Yeah.
So, you know, every artist has these bits of, you know, studies on paper or whatever, drawings, prints, whatever, lying around that never really get into the mainstream market. So really that was what I realized. All I had to do was create a market for that. But it had to be a zero cost market because by making it zero cost, we could keep the prices low enough to generate a rapid income, a rapid return, and that would create an income.
And where are you selling your works to around the world?
All over, yeah. So I sell... A third of my work goes to America, but it goes all over the place. I mean, Europe, it varies. I mean, it goes up and down, you know, depending on what's going on in global politics. I mean, what I'm learning, you know, very quickly from doing this is what a difference politics makes. You know, if there's something weird going on in politics, it has a knock-on effect within that country quite quickly, within hours. So it's very interesting for me to see that. Mm. So... and it can be good or bad things. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm, it's not necessarily bad things. It can be, you know, if everyone's celebrating something, they're not busy buying art, are they? So you know, which is fine. I kind of think it doesn't matter. That's just the nature of it. It's interesting to see it. But certainly, you know, all over the world.
I was just particularly wondering, like, if you sell a 200-pound piece and you send it, let's say, to California or Australia, you know, how much do you end up spending on postage? And so what is the ultimate take home?
Yeah, well, you put the postage package on top of the price. That goes on top of the £200.
Okay.
But it only costs me, it varies, but it's about £12 to £15.
Okay.
To send it to the US.
Okay.
And where it's going.
Okay. Got it.
It's not a huge amount.
Right. Totally. Yeah, that's a really solid living. I do want to go back to what you said as you were describing people setting up one of these for themselves. You said it's quite, I think you said something along the lines of it's quite easy to sell, you know, to sort of make your sales. I just want to be sure, I want to fact check that, I guess.
I want to qualify that as well.
Yeah. Good. So maybe a good way to frame that would be what are some of the most important criteria? I mean, certainly marketability, I would imagine, is right up there. But maybe for you, both big picture wise and details wise, what are some of the criteria for setting up a successful campaign in terms of what one's work is like?
Yeah, I think there's a few very basic things. One is a good photograph of the work.
Mm.
It's amazing how often I see that not being done.
Right.
A good photograph that really shows it. And even maybe if the work's, you know, textured and got something on it that it's hard to see in the main photograph, take some details as well.
Right.
A clear description of what it is, and that when you post it, they also post the Art Support Pledge red tile and the text about what Art Support Pledge is. And some people don't bother because you don't actually have to. You can still use the hashtag and it will still go on to the hashtag. But actually, it actually improves your chances of being seen if you use the content that is part of the hashtag,
mm-hmm.
part of the campaign,
mm-hmm.
because the algorithms pick up on these things. And also, we highlight artists that do it really well on the pledge,
mm-hmm.
on the account,
mm-hmm.
and that actually helps drive up their visibility. So it really helps generally to do it right. Also, I mean, so in effect, do it well,
right?
But don't, you know, that might take a bit of practice. You don't worry if you don't get it right the first time. The other thing really is that it is a marketplace. And like any marketplace, you've got to find the right product at the right price. And that sounds very cold and calculated, but it's no different in a way than any other marketplace, than the gallery or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that can take a little bit of playing around. But what's interesting is it might surprise you what it is. So it's not always what you expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, and one of the things I think is really interesting about it is because it's broken down all the barriers of how normal art markets work. Anyone can go on it and anyone can buy the work. A lot of people who work in art galleries, for example, who can't necessarily afford to buy the work that is on their walls, are buying work off it because they know what they're looking for.
Mm.
They know it's a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
So they're buying adventurous pieces. They're buying, you know, not necessarily stuff that is obviously sellable.
Right.
So there is, you know, don't assume that it's only kind of for work that is obviously commercial.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's surprisingly not necessarily the case, but also just play around with it. I mean, I've found that, you know, from my experience of doing it, I've been surprised what's sold sometimes.
Mm.
The market's much more forgiving than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, you can use an art market up. So if you sell a lot of one sort of work, at some point you might find it stops selling. And you've got to stop, you know, like anything, you've got to start reinventing it. And it's also what's interesting is I find that if you start selling on it and you're doing quite well, people get quite sensitive to a good and a bad one. So they will actually ignore the bad ones.
Mm.
And if that happens, learn from it. You know, so I've just put it down to experience, gone, okay, you know, maybe that one's not good enough. I shouldn't have put it on. I just take it off. And actually, that's a really good learning curve. I mean, a lot of artists have told me that they've learned a lot by doing this because it's so rapid. You know, mm-hmm. mostly in the art world, you know, you put an exhibition on every now and again, and you never really get a feel for how the market understands and wants or desires your work, because it's a very slow plodding market for most.
Mm.
obviously not for some, but for most artists, that's the case. So to have a marketplace where it's really quick, it actually, I find, for me and for many artists I've spoken to, really instilled a sense of confidence that actually they could take risks.
Yeah.
Because actually they could respond to what was going on it. And actually, yes, some work might be less marketable than others, but it could still sell. So it wasn't as if you just then had to only put certain sorts of work on. So it's very difficult to tell. Just play with it is one of the things I would say, is test it out, see what works. And even things like if you're putting, and this might sound quite obvious, but it's amazing how often we, you know, all of us get this wrong. If you're putting work on that's going to be extremely expensive to ship, then there's a very good chance that you're not going to sell it, because everyone will be looking at it going, I like it, but that's going to be really expensive to ship.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I do is I generally, not always, but put work on that's under a certain size. And that size is a sort of limit for the UK postal system. When you go above that size, the prices go up considerably on shipping.
Right.
So I just make work slightly smaller than that size. It's a very simple simple decision to do. I mean, it's not that I was making, you know, having to compromise massively. I make work that size anyway. It was just make sure it's that size. So just simple things like that can really help make it a lot easier. I mean, the other thing as well is to remember that it's a dynamic platform. So it's not like a shop window or a gallery where you put work on the wall and walk away. You don't just post it, walk away and expect it to sell. And then if it doesn't sell, leave it there. You know, it's Instagram and it's a hashtag. It'll have about 24 hours where it's been seen by a lot of people. After that 24 hours, then it will severely diminish how many people see it. So you've got to sort of post new work fairly regularly. And if after a few days you don't get any interest in it, but you still think it's a good piece and worth posting, delete it and repost it, because then it will get seen again.
Oh, that's great advice. Yeah. And how you should be posting maybe once every day as part of to be successful in this project?
You don't have to do it every day. I mean, the one thing that really helps is to decide how often you think you can post. So don't set yourself up for doing it every day if you can't do it every day, because the way the algorithms work on Instagram is they like consistency.
Right.
So they will understand when you the patterns of behavior you use in posting, and they'll replicate it and they will use it to the advantage of the algorithm. So you need to create a pattern of behavior and stick to it. So decide, for example, what I do is I post generally at the weekends. So I don't tend to do it in the week. So I'm not, I just want to get on my work in the week. And obviously I'm doing a lot of work on running our support pledge. So I don't really be worried about selling work. So I tend to only do it on sort of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and sometimes on Monday as well. And the weekends are the peak days for selling. So, Monday tends to be quite good, because I think it has a kind of fall off from Sunday, and Sunday's the top day for selling work on it. It's the day when the most amount of sales are made.
So I was going to ask you actually that related to that. So you think generally the best day for posting is the weekend, Sunday in particular?
Yeah. I mean, it really varies. I mean, I know people doing it who post twice a day, every day, morning and evening, at exactly the same time. And they make two pieces of work a day for it. And they've done that every single day, 7 days a week since the beginning.
Wow.
And actually, if you can do that, that's the best way of doing it, because the algorithms love it. And they love your consistency. So you post on the same days at the same time.
Okay.
So I always post about 7:30 in the evening in UK time. And I'll post again a bit later in the evening, normally about sort of 10 o'clock UK time, because that picks up on the American market, which is, you know, 5 hours or more behind the UK. So when I go to bed, the American market are looking at my work overnight, and then in the morning I can pick up the sales.
Nice. That's a pretty sweet way to make a living.
Yeah, I mean, who would have guessed?
I know. Just a couple more questions. So one is, have you seen people connect their support pledge with some kind of fundraiser type thing?
Yeah, and we did that right from the beginning, actually, because it became successful really quickly. Within the first couple of weeks, we were already supporting other charities. So what we were suggesting is that artists who were doing really well on it donate part of their income to, you know, relevant charities. So right. We all sorts from, you know, when the issues in America, the Black Lives Matter, we were getting people to support various charities that were dealing with quality issues and right. with also in the UK with mental health issues around the arts. So things that were kind of relevant given the cultural setting and the political setting over the last 8 months.
Got it. And big question here, and I think I know the answer to this based on what we talked about before, but you're doing this as a passion project, even though you're profiting from it and you're doing well from it, but all the time that you contribute to maintain it is you're not being compensated for, correct? It's strictly out of your support and belief in the system and the project.
Yeah. I've been doing it for free for 8 months now.
Wow.
I am getting some donations now through the website people, you know, have donated money to it.
Uh-huh.
And that's now covering things like the IT expenses and, mm-hmm. you know, because there are many, it's amazing how many expenses there are doing something like this. And they're fairly minor. I mean, you know, at some points they were getting expensive because I was having to invest in all the IT to kind of keep it going. But largely now it's just about kind of paying the fees on, you know, the various kind of internet platforms I have to manage it all, and consultant fees, and, you know, there's the odd kind of legal fees and stuff like that. So that covers that. So I'm not having to pay that out anymore. At the beginning, I was having to pay all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't make a wage out of it. So I do run it and manage it for free. I mean, I'm not begrudging of that at all. To be honest, it's been the greatest privilege of my life, you know, to know that you've helped support your peers and colleagues across the world is like the best reward, I can tell you, that you could ever imagine.
Right.
So if that's the best I get out of it, great.
That's
not too
great.
Worried.
That
I
is,
mean, going forward, you know, I am applying for funding and sponsorship deals, stuff like that, so that we can actually, the plan is that I can then employ staff to run it and manage it.
Right.
And actually, it is already a not-for-profit company, but to run that properly and to keep it going, and also to invest then in development, because obviously my priority is being an artist, and I need to get back to doing that full time. So I can't be doing this, you know, running our support pledge forever at the level I've been doing it.
How many hours a week are you putting in, typically?
Now I've got it down to sort of, you know, about 5 hours a day, which is pretty good, because, you know, for months on end, I was doing minimum 14, 18 hours a day.
Jesus.
7 days a week.
Wow. And
there was never a day off. It was full on, non-stop.
Wow. That's much more time than I was even imagining, at least that initial run. But
I didn't think it would take any time at all. I thought, once, you know, you just add a hashtag, what else do you have to do?
Right. Well, how much of that time is just, you know, strictly kind of technical maintenance versus correspondence and what have you?
The technical bit, and actually just, you know, actually putting stuff out there doesn't take that much time.
Yeah.
You know, that's fairly minor. I mean, as it's gone on, that's taken more time, because obviously as it's grown and become bigger, you have to get it right. You can't be mucking around getting it wrong. I made a lot of mistakes at the beginning and didn't matter because it was part of it. Whereas now, you know, it's out in the world, it's big, and people expect me to get it right. So everything takes a lot longer when you've got to get it perfect each time you do it.
Right.
But most of what I do actually these days is I do a lot of things like this. So I probably do few podcasts a week. I do press interviews every day. Some days I can do 4 or 5 press interviews a day. So that takes up, you know, quite a lot of time.
Right.
And then correspondence, you know, I get, some of it is just people emailing me to ask me questions about how to do it, or which I try not to deal with those sorts of things, because actually the information is all out there.
Right.
It's all on either the account or on the website.
Right.
So I hope largely that people will find that and then they'll know what to do. If it's a circumstance where it's people contacting me from specifically a country where they may need more help because they because of language issues, or you know, there might be literal barriers for their use of it, I do go out my way in those circumstances to help them. But if it's you know, if it's someone who, if they just typed it into Google, they'd find it. I don't worry about it so much. But then I get a lot of things like you know, businesses, tech entrepreneurs, charities, fashion houses, you name it, wine companies, mm-hmm. contacting me who want to, you know, help, sponsor, do something, you know, hotels, you name it. You'd be amazed what I get. And I think partly because people are inspired by its kind of cultural generosity and they want to get be a part of it. And it can be everything from, you know, this week I've been dealing with Google through to, you know, a small charity that's might want some help, or, you know, might want me to,
right,
to be involved in it in some way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I am completely sold based on all that we've talked about. And I feel obligated, or, you know, maybe inspired is a better word, to do an artist support pledge myself. Maybe in advance of the holidays would be a good time. I will say I am scared. Probably not the level of fear that dying from hypothermia inspires, but there's definitely a little bit of fear there, fear of failure. But yeah, but I think it's definitely worth a try, and I think hopefully our listener base can get involved. Maybe some of them already are, even I'm just not aware of it. But yeah.
Well, actually, on that sense of fear of getting involved, actually, which a few people have sort of said to me, I think one of the things that people tell me who've got used to it and have been using it is how kind of open it is to failure.
Mm.
In that, the great thing about it is if you put something on and it doesn't work and it doesn't get sold, you can just take it off again.
Right.
You know, it's not there for the whole world to see all the time. And if you don't get it right, you can just try again. So in a way, I think that enables people to have a very fluid relationship to it. They don't have to feel like, you know, it's make or break each time. And it can take, and the other thing that I think is important is, it, if you start doing it, it normally takes most people, if even when they're successful on it, a couple of weeks for it to really start to kick in. And I think, I'm not absolutely sure why this is, but the advice I've been given is because it takes a while for the, you know, the algorithms, et cetera, to sort of pick up on your patterns of behavior and use of it. And so once it does that, it starts pushing you out more and more and more, and more people see your work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those things, you've kind of got to bear with it. You know, you've got to work out your pattern of behavior. When are you going to post? What days? What time?
Mm.
Do that and stick to it.
Right.
And don't be worried about editing it. You know, if you do it and you think, oh, I don't really like that image, just take it off. It's your account. You know, it's your Instagram account. So you don't have to worry about that. And like I said, if it doesn't sell and it's been on there a few days and you think it's still worth another shot, leave it maybe 2 weeks and then delete it and repost and post it again.
Mm.
Because what happens in that is it gets, you know, the Instagram pushes it around again, pushes it out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So more new people are seeing it, because it's not just your followers that are seeing it. It's the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers of the hashtag that are seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the beauties of it, is if you just did, you know, put your work on your account for sale, only your followers would see it,
mm-hmm.
and want to buy it. But mm-hmm. by using the hashtag, all of the other people who are using the hashtag, their followers are seeing it too. And they're, you know, those, everyone who's following the hashtag is seeing it. So, which is a lot of people. So it means that, you know, you've got a huge market, and that's one of the reasons why it's really effective.
Right. Have you actually been in conversation with Instagram themselves because you've been so viral with this project?
I've tried, but mm-hmm. you know,
the firewall.
Instagram impossible to get hold of.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I've had to speak to, you know, a lot of people who are kind of experts of this stuff to kind of upskill me.
Right.
I mean, you know, when I started doing this, I wasn't in any way an expert on social media.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very basic user of Instagram. I used it. I posted images of my work every now and again. That was it.
Mm.
But because of I was doing this, I had to learn very quickly how it works mm-hmm. and how to best use it. So mm-hmm. I was hiring consultants to upskill me, you know, talking to people nearly every day.
Wow.
To sort of learn how to do it. So I've learned over the last 8 months, you know, how it works and how best to do it. And there's a lot going on behind the scenes with social media that none of us are, I think, ever going to understand.
Sure.
But on a basic level, it's fairly simple. And the other thing as well, which is quite interesting, is if you don't already use stories or reels,
mm-hmm.
they're really useful for increasing the amount of people who see the work.
Mm.
Because Instagram favor stories and reels
mm-hmm.
when it comes to pushing images out into the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you make a post of your work, say you've put a post on, you know, on Friday, Saturday night, say, and on Sunday night, perhaps on Sunday, you might want to do a story where you have all of those images on the story, because then that will get pushed out to more people and bring in more traffic.
Right. Well, Matthew, I want to thank you for several things. I want to thank you for starting our support pledge, for all the work that you've put in maintaining it. Thank you for talking to me, and thank you for, as somebody who's doing multiple recordings related to this event and articles, presumably too. Thank you for not sounding like it too.
Yeah. That's all right. I enjoy them. It's a pleasure to do these things.
That's great. And we're out.